So, welcome to Sci-Fi in Color, the podcast where we discuss science fiction TV and movies that feature actors, directors, and writers of color. I'm Maggie.
And I'm Melissa. If you want to get in touch with us, you can email us at sfincolor@gmail.com. You can also find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Tumblr as SF in Color.
Today, we are talking about Godzilla, or Gojira, which is the 1954, sorry, I know I said 1951 in an earlier podcast, I was completely wrong, the 1954 Japanese sci-fi monster movie film, the original one, I guess.
I'm probably going to switch back and forth between Godzilla and Gojira, so that's just a warning.
Do you want to just stick with Gojira? I think that's what most people call the, like, original film that was released a couple years back in English.
Or okay, I'll try and whatever. Do that, but I make no promises.
But yeah, you guys know what we mean if we switch between Godzilla and Gojira.
It's all the same thing. So there are spoilers, so if you haven't seen it, please go watch it. Or you can just listen to us without knowing what's going on. That's fine, too.
That's also fine. I know finding this film is a little bit difficult. Like, I know Melissa was kind of put on this crazy hunt to go find it last night online.
Procrastination always pays off.
Because the thing is, this film, so it's originally a Japanese film, and then it was released in America, I'm not sure what year.
1956.
Okay, so it was released in America 2 years later. Thank you, Melissa. Yes, for doing this research.
That's why I'm here.
It was released 2 years later for the American market, and that version had a lot of weird cuts in it with some American guy kind of speaking in a news bulletin kind of fashion, I believe. So we're not talking about that version, although I think that's the version that most older Americans are familiar with. We're talking about the actual original version that came out in 54 and was, like, actually released to the American market, I think, in, like, 2004, 2006, something like that. So, like, 50 years later. I guess they had a 50 years anniversary celebration or something.
Yeah.
So we're talking about the original old Godzilla movies. So if you listen to us and you still have no idea what we're talking about, you probably saw the edited American 56 version or something. So I apologize in advance, because I know this is kind of hard to find the original version. I had to go, like, look through my local libraries, and only, like, two libraries had the right copy. I had to, like, drive 15 minutes to go pick up, like, the right copy.
It is on Amazon, though, so you can rent it for $4, which is awesome. What I did. And it's... that works.
Yeah, so you can rent it on Amazon, or you can drive to every library in your area and try to find it, I guess.
One of the two, definitely.
One of those.
I think that sums the two of us up pretty well, actually.
So if you're cheap like me, you could go to the library, or if you are, I guess, more Amazon. I don't know if I'll call you more Amazon, Melissa. But if you're more like, I'd rather watch this on my computer screen, then I guess Amazon's a place to go if you have $4 to spare on original Gojira. Cool. So I've seen this movie before. I saw most of it in class. So some of the more fluffy love triangle stuff, we just kind of skipped.
I don't know why.
And so I've seen it. So I did take notes, but I kind of know what happens already. So I'm kind of interested to hear from Melissa, who has not seen this film before. So what did you think?
So, like I mentioned in the Pacific Rim episode, I'm not big into monster movies, and I really don't have any basis for comparison. So that just needs to set that up right up front. Sure. But I actually really liked this movie.
Oh,
I think it is... There are pieces of it which are very dated, and it's actually... I mean, like, understandably, the monster is... Whatever, you know, it's not fantastic, but that's not even part of the dated part. Just the whole feeling of the movie itself. But it doesn't even matter, because the heart of the movie is so well done that it everything else kind of gets pushed aside. And as soon as you start focusing on, like, the thematic issues, it really comes together as, like, a piece of artwork, I guess. I really liked it. I thought
I'm glad you liked it.
Most things worked really well. I think the beginning was a little slow.
Okay, yeah.
And the way that it was kind of, I don't know, the style or the editing made it feel very disjointed at the beginning. But once we started getting through to the middle, we started getting the characters. I told you, I'm all about the characters. That's, even if you skip the romance, I'm all about the romance and the characters and whatever. But as soon as we started getting into that stuff, I was pretty set. I was pretty happy.
Okay. Yeah, I definitely have, I feel like I have a, I'm not as character driven, so we have a good fit going on here. You can talk more about the characters, and I can talk about how I don't understand how this one character fit into the movie, and you can, I guess, explain to me why or why not. So let's start from the beginning, shall we?
We shall. So, this I don't first... know why I did
that. So we first start off, there's just like a nice, peaceful fishing boat on the ocean. Everyone's just chilling, playing music, whatever, relaxing. And then all of a sudden, there's a large flash of light. And, you know, I think all of a sudden people start, like, falling. I just wrote in my notes, reminds me of old Trek scenes with cheesiness or an attack. Because I don't know if you're familiar with the, like, 1968 Star Trek TV show. But anytime they would get, you know, attacked by another ship or something... this is a starship. So anytime they would get attacked by another ship, like, people, they would have, like, the camera would go, like, tilted, and people would launch themselves out of their chairs. So, like, it just kind of reminded me of that cheesiness of an attack in the Star Trek, TV show.
Yeah.
Just because, like, they kind of overreacted a bit with, like, the flying out of their seats thing.
Yeah, definitely.
I know it's supposed to be a somber moment.
I know.
But, and that's, I guess, how it dates itself a little bit. Because, like, how we do action scenes now is very different from how they did action scenes then.
Yeah, absolutely. But I really liked that the first scene was, like, legit. You know, I feel like that isn't something that we see very much. Especially just, I don't know, in modern films, everything has to be set up pretty well. Or you just, if you're having a monster movie, the first scene isn't usually a monster movie. I'm not an expert in these things, but I feel like you don't just jump right in. You give some backstory, you give some characters, and this is just like, you came to see a monster movie, here's the monster.
Yeah, even though we don't know yet that flash of light was Godzilla, we do find out, you know.
Yeah.
There's the monster. He's already in frame one, technically, I guess.
Yeah, I think, you know, it really sets him up to be the main character. I don't know if I should say that, but he's kind of...
No, I think Godzilla is the main character.
Yeah, I think he's a central character at the very least, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the special effects and the shaky cam... It was, at the beginning, it was more distracting, I think, but as we got through the movie, I kind of just kind of got used to it, but the first scene where they all just kind of threw themselves to the side, I was like, this is a really important moment, and I should not laugh, so I did not laugh, but I thought about it, and I held it back.
Can I say, so I don't know if you skipped the intro credits, I tend not to, because, like... We are told as cinema majors to never skip the beginning or, like,
no,
the
I
first
saw that.
10 seconds of the end. But when I was watching this film for the first time in, like, a large, dark theater, and that, like, crazy Godzilla noise shows up, that, like, screechy, warble thing, I honestly was like, that's some scary stuff. Like, dude, if I was... in the 50s and I watch this movie, I'd probably be pissing my pants. Like, I thought, like, I love that Godzilla sound effect. Like, I don't know, I think I looked it up later, and I think it was something like how they made it was like a rubber glove and like a violin bow or string or some crazy combination of things. But I have to say mad props to the Foley artists for getting that awesome sound effect in, because it sounded
pretty legit.
I like the sound effect, you know? What was that? It kind of reminds me when we did Attack the Block, and we talked about the noises that the monsters make in Attack the Block. Remember I listed, like, 50 different animals that they use? But it's so funny, like, Godzilla's so much more simpler. They only had, like, maybe 5 different things going on for one sound effect, but it still had a very, like, I guess, visceral kind of creepy effect on your soul. I don't know. I like the sound effect. I thought it was scary when I first heard it.
No, it's very fitting for him.
You know, low-key and, I guess, not as state-of-the-art entertainment technology as it could have been. So, yeah. Any other notes about the very beginning of the movie for you?
No, that's about it.
Okay. So then we launch into, you know, they radio out a signal or something. They do a Morse code or SOS or something. And then, you know, there's all this clamor from all the people about, oh, what happened to the people in the boat? Like, I think it was called the Bingo was one of the boats. And then I can't remember the other name of the boat. I just remember Bingo being the name of one of the boats.
Bingo was its name, though.
Then we get a classic newspaper montage.
Yeah.
I'm so, like, can I just say, we did talk about this back in 2011. Like, it's so sad that newspapers are dying.
Yeah.
No longer will we get the spinning newspaper montage in the movie, or someone's been transported back in time and has to reach into a trash can and find the latest, like, Back to the Future reference. Well, they have to go look for, like, what day is it, and it's, oh, it's 1955 or something, you know?
Yeah.
It's just, I mean, I guess now when people go forward or back in time, they have to go, like, steal someone's iPhone or something and, like, check the date or something.
Well, I mean, I'm probably the last young person who's team newspaper. Like, I still read the newspaper. How many, you know, 20-somethings can say that?
True.
So, I'm gonna miss it when it dies out with all the old people. But at least if people time travel back to our time, they'll still be able to use the newspaper in the trash bin trick, because we still have newspapers. So it's only in the future when they get rid of newspapers and there's time travel into that period. So we're still a good ways off of the time travel conundrum.
Mm-hmm. The time travel conundrum.
I don't know how I said that with, like, a straight face.
I'm trying to, like, it's really funny. I'm trying to decipher my notes that I wrote down, but, like, some of them are only half notes, so I don't know what they mean.
There's,
so
maybe they're just no.
No, I mean, I think there's enough that I could play a game where I could ask you to try to fill in the blank. So let me do this right now. I wrote down, and this is, I'm going through my notes in chronological order. So this is after newspaper. I wrote down, you know you live in a small village when, and I never wrote down what it was, but there was something about the way the island villagers reacted to, oh, I think I actually do know what I was talking about. Now that I verbalized it, I remember what I meant to say. But what do you think, Melissa?
Well, I think you're talking about how they're kind of country folk. It was very clear the source of, not conflict exactly, because it isn't really come to fruition in the film, but it's very clear about how differently the city folk, like the professor who comes in, and the country folk see the entire situation, whether they see it through science or whether they see it through like folk stories or stuff like that. And I think that's probably just highlights the changing times as Japan industrializes further. I don't know if that's what you were going for at all, but let's see what you were actually going for.
Hey, man, I like your analysis. I think that's very valid. I think I was thinking about their reactions to, again, Godzilla. Maybe not framed in the science versus folklore kind of dichotomy, but I was thinking more like just the way everyone gathers at one spot. Like, I remember when they were looking for radiation with the Geiger counters, everyone was gathered around. I think, wasn't the first... Oh, I think I'm referring to the... when the boat with the survivors washes up on shore, everyone is on the beach. Like, everyone is there. No one in the village is anywhere else. Like, they all came to see what's going on. And even later on, when we start getting someone banging the warning gong or warning symbol that Godzilla has arrived, everyone starts rushing. Like, you get a sense of, I guess, community with these people, because they are so close together. You know, when people pass away from a natural disaster, aka not natural disaster, it's actually Godzilla. You know, like, people are together. So,
Yeah.
Yeah, and it just seems like the way they reacted to these large events was so, I guess, provincial, as we're talking about. But, no, I like that dichotomy. And I know I was telling Melissa, I had a friend over who was watching this movie with me, and his name's Steven, and he studied some Japanese back in high school. And he was talking to me about how the Islanders definitely have a very specific dialect that they speak in, mm-hmm. and he liked that kind of touch in the film, because you could tell the way they were speaking was very different from the way the people in the city were speaking. And I'm not an expert on dialects, but I could definitely hear that there was some kind of accent thing going on.
Right.
So he appreciated that kind of mm-hmm. nice touch in the yeah. film.
I was really surprised by how many extras there were in the film.
There were many extras, yeah.
There was a lot of scenes which had a lot of people in them, which I feel like maybe that's cinema coming full circle, because it used to be a lot easier to get extras than it would be to create CGI extras. And they're yes. used, like, I remember watching, I don't remember which one of the Lord of the Rings movies, and, you know, they have huge armies, and it's crazy, because they didn't gather 100,000 people. Those people aren't real. Whoa, mm-hmm. that's crazy. Look how much technology has advanced. And yet, when I look back in old movies that actually have real people as extras in the background, I'm just so impressed, because we just don't get that as much anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's a
like the, all those people concern. on the beach. I don't know how many people there was. I'm horrible at estimating how many people were there, but that was a lot of people.
Hmm. Hey, you want to work on this monster movie film? Sure.
Why not?
Okay, come down for the weekend. Yeah. No, I never thought of it that way. It makes you like, huh? That's really interesting. I guess it's like nowadays it's more of a concern of like budget.
Oh, yeah, like, absolutely.
In what case does it make sense to just hire an extra and pay them however much per day to show up?
Right, exactly.
And direct them and make them do specific
like,
things.
I'm not
or
saying,
versus the cost of CGI.
Yeah, so, like, I'm not saying there aren't extras, like, on TV, like, or in film. And because there are, like, think about, like, dance scenes in gyms. Think about how many extras have to be in those. Like, there's a right. lot of extras. But, like, all the times there are extras, they're very necessary to the film. Like, all those people on the
yes,
beach,
yes.
they were not necessary, but they enhanced it.
Yeah, because, I mean, even though it's a small village, this village is populated by people. Like,
exactly.
You
good
have
point.
To, no, I know it sounds like a stupid thing to say, but...
No. I was
you
agreeing.
Know.
I wasn't being condescending. Sorry.
Okay. Sometimes I can't really tell. But, you know, like... It does enhance the film, just having... Because I wouldn't have that sense of community if it was only shot in such a way where we're just focusing on the main characters.
Right.
Like, I guess, the brother and, the, I guess I'll call him the younger brother character with the shaved head. And, like, you know, it and the professor. Like, if we only focus on those three characters, it wouldn't really have the same feel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you wouldn't feel the impact that Godzilla is having on this town or this island. Personally, when I... thought of Godzilla this time around, or like knew he was coming, it's kind of reminded me of like, I guess this is the part where they were doing the folk dance
mm-hmm.
to like drive Godzilla away. I don't know why, but I wrote down Kraken. Like, this kind of reminded me of Pirates of the Caribbean. Like, there's something in the ocean and it's coming for you. Like, so I wrote down Kraken. I really liked that ceremonial scene.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was really interesting, and I thought it was also very well lit. Like, I have to say, this movie has not entirely, but there are some pretty good shots and pretty good, like, there's good lighting in this movie. That's, like, when it comes to black and white films, this might be the first black and white film we're talking about, actually, on the show.
Ah,
is it?
I think it is. I can't think of any others.
Yeah. One thing I do love about the black and white films is... like, the lighting has to be on point, or else the movie's gonna look terrible. And, yeah, so that's, like, most black and white films that stand the test of time. They look awesome, because they're lit very well. So I have to say, mad props to the lighting, at least in that scene, when they're doing the ceremonial dance, because it looked awesome.
I like how there's that one guy who knows what's going on. You know what I mean?
Oh, the old guy?
I'm like, in a horror movie, there's always that one guy who knows. And everyone's like, no, 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 it's definitely not. And he's like, I know.
I just know this to be true, that there's a thing called Gojira in the ocean that we used to sacrifice young girls to, and now we don't.
I was just reading an article about how modern civilization is based on human sacrifice. So that was interesting, but it was a timely addition, but okay.
So basically, human culture, we've always been about human sacrifice. Even now.
Where do you live?
No. Aren't you talking about, like, in metaphorical terms?
No. I meant literally. It was about how human sacrifice, literal human sacrifice, is the basis for a lot of modern civilization.
Okay, when you said that earlier, I either misheard you or you missaid what you meant to say. Because I totally thought you meant that people metaphorically are sacrificed in today's society, which is similar to how people were literally sacrificed in past societies. That's what I thought you meant.
Well, that's pretty deep, and I probably should have said that, but
but that's a whole other topic. So
whole other topic. Let's just move on.
Yes. I did like in some cases the use of, so they used miniatures a lot in this film. Right. They used little models of houses getting stomped on or getting crushed. You thought they were adorable?
I thought they were. Isn't that bad?
Yeah, I guess I'm pretty, as a movie watcher, movie goer, whatever, I'm pretty naive. I will pretty much buy any kind of special effects. But when it comes to watching the second time around, I will, of course, know going in that that's just a little cardboard house or whatever, little plastic house or something. So, I think when I... Oh, the audio just went a little weird. Man, I thought I fixed that problem. Okay, let me say that again just because I want to re-record. Okay, so when I first watched this, I guess I didn't really notice the miniatures, but upon second viewing, I was definitely more aware of the miniature houses and things like that, and the little models. I like them. I thought, I guess I can agree with you. I thought they were cute.
I liked the little trains. I think those were my favorite. Those were really cute.
And, I mean, I guess that's just, I guess, part of just the time period it was made in and the budget they had. They wanted to just keep it kind of low-key and not spend too much on it.
Well, I don't know how they would have, I'm not an expert in special effects, but I don't know how else they would have done it.
That's true. Like, they couldn't have done it during that time period. I can't really think of another way they could have done it.
Again, I'm not an expert in 1950s special effects, but...
But I did think when... That scene, when they're on the island at night and all the villagers are trying to go to sleep, it's really funny because it's... there are, like, two characters that we kind of focus on a little bit at the beach. We have the younger brother with the shaved head, and we have the older brother with his wife, I think. So they're all sleeping in their house. Suddenly, you know, the wind picks up, there's a storm, and for some reason, the younger brother, like, runs outside, which I thought was stupid, because I'm like, bro, you don't just run outside into a storm. But actually, he was a smart one, because it ended up that his brother and the brother's wife get crushed slash killed under Godzilla's foot while the younger one survives. It was a very strange situation. Yeah. I don't think I quite understood it the first time I watched it. I understood it a little bit more this time, but it was still weird.
Yeah, it was really confusing for me. Because when the younger one ran out, I was like, you dead, son. You dead.
Right? That's my same thought.
I was just like, wait, this trope is not being fulfilled? Help! I've fallen and cannot get up. Guess how reliant I am on certain expectations of films that when it's not
right?
met, not the expected way, I just go, help, I don't know what to do. I have to use my brain.
Because you expect that the young, like in a horror movie, and this isn't really a horror movie, but in a horror movie, if you run outside when something is happening, like a storm, you're going to die. That's the horror movie trope. But then the trope gets kind of subverted, and it ends up the people inside the house end up dying, which is really bizarre.
Yeah, it was weird. But it was good, but it was a little confusing.
It was confusing. I think like the main point of that was we had to get the younger brother over to the main couple's they had to kind of inject him into the main couple's family.
I don't know why.
For plot reasons, but I still don't understand why. And I was gonna say this for later, but I'm gonna just bring it up now. I don't understand the point of the younger brother character. He, to me, does not add really anything to the story.
No, I don't know completely why agree.
He's in there, unless it's to make you feel some kind of way, like, oh, I feel sad for the villagers, or, oh, look, this couple's taking care of him and helping him with school, but, like, I don't care. I don't care if they're helping him with school. Like, he doesn't add anything to the story. I mean, he cries at the end, and I was like, oh, yeah, I totally forgot you were in this film. Like, you were gone for, like, the last half of it. What is your purpose, son? But...
Well, honestly, I was kind of confused that it was the same person.
Oh, okay.
I didn't understand. Like, how did he go from one place to the other? I mean, like, there's transportation, but I don't understand logically, how he fit into their family dynamic.
Yeah, that's the question I ended up with by the end of the film, because I understand logically how it happened. His brother and his brother's wife, I think, passed away. So he's an orphan now. He kind of ends up being taken under the professor / Emiko / I can't remember the main guy's name, under their, like, family, like, under their wing. So he kind of ends up getting, like, kind of semi-adopted by them and kind of merges with their family, but I don't understand why he's important. Like, the only thing we get is, okay, so one of the villagers needed to die, and we needed to see this happen. But, and then later on, at the end, he cries, or the little brother, he cries when Sarazawa dies. But that's it. Like, there's no reason for him to be in the film.
I don't know. Maybe he's, like, a symbol for something.
For youth? I don't know. It was definitely a strange
decision. He's kind of superfluous. I don't know why I just had so much trouble saying that word. But, yeah, he's kind of unnecessary in his existence. Maybe he's there for sympathy, but I could have done without him.
Yeah, we get sympathy for the younger characters and the children in many other scenes later in the movie. Where,
much
you know,
better done.
Yeah, like where the mother's shielding her children and says, you know, we're going to see your father soon. That's, like, you know, being a reference to, I guess, him dying in World War II. And then we also get a scene when they're in that, like, kind of makeshift hospital, and this mother, this child is crying because her mother is being taken away. Like, those are very emotional scenes that we get sympathy and, like, they don't involve the younger brother at all, so I don't know why he's in the film. It was a very strange choice.
I don't know.
So, yeah. I don't know. It just seemed like he was kind of, again, extraneous, superfluous, whatever. Vocabulary cast. Yeah. okay, so I don't think I have any other notes about that first kind of land sighting of Godzilla. But we move later into this kind of nice courtroom where everyone's kind of dressed up and making their case about, should we go public with this knowledge and look at this projection slide of a brontosaurus? Like, I kind of like the contrast between, like, the provincial island and, like, this, like, nice, orderly, modern kind of courtroom.
Yeah.
Like, the juxtaposition really worked for me. I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah.
I don't know if you have any more notes about
No, I really that. Liked the scenes that took place there. I like how there's this one guy who's like, let's not make this public. And all the guys around him clap. And then the girl's like, this is stupid. I'm like, I'm team girl here.
Yeah.
She says, I think, the truth is the truth. And is there a bigger truth than the government always lying to its people? I don't think there is. That's like a fact of life. That's been since the beginning of humanity. It's just something we can all just relate to on a human level. Governments kind of suck sometimes. But, you know.
Have we have a bit of a libertarian kind of bent to this podcast today or something? Like,
I think anyone of any persuasion can agree with me that sometimes governments lie to its people and sometimes they should not.
Oh, bureaucracy. just to kind of backtrack before we go more in depth about the slideshows and going public thing, Serizawa is the scientist, the younger scientist in the film. I just kind of laughed that he had an eye patch under his eyeglasses in, like, the first scene we see him in. I mean, you know, no offense to Serizawa. He probably lost the eye in, like, the war or something. Again, probably another World War II casualty shout out. But I just thought, like, he's trying way too hard to be, like, Batman, serious, save the world. Look at me, I have one eye patch or something.
As opposed to two eye patches?
As opposed to... And then that great scene where everyone's just kind of... So, again, this is before the slideshow with the Brontosaurus and before they go public with the information. So the scene on the island where they're doing the Geiger counter thing and all of a sudden Godzilla shows up and they sound the warning bells and everyone's literally running from one side of the island to the other side of the island. I mean, I just kind of love how Godzilla just kind of peeks his head up over the island and then just goes back down. Like, bro, what are you doing? Just playing hide and seek with the villagers.
Maybe he's just lonely.
I feel like something went wrong, horribly wrong, with the scale of the monster, because the size of his head in comparison to the island, and then later on the size of his footprints in the sand compared to the size of the island did not quite make sense, unless that island has a very, very high mountain or something. It was a little odd. But again, you know, special effects are not the forte of this film, so you just kind of brush past it. I really, this is where I first get a sense of it, and it didn't really ever go away. I do not like Emiko's actress's acting. It's just so bad. The girl?
Yeah.
Her acting was just so subpar in this film.
I actually didn't mind it, and maybe really? Because I think the actress is extraordinarily pretty and has a body I would probably kill for, maybe multiple times. but it didn't really bother me. I kept just, I don't know. I think my bigger problems were with her character, maybe. And some of the actions that she took were very okay. And some of them were just a little not
okay.
she is, I had mixed feelings about her. I think that's the easiest way to sum it up.
Okay.
There were some scenes where I found her acting annoying. I will definitely give you that. But overall, it wasn't as glaring as the missteps on her characterization. That is a, look at me, summing things up nicely.
Yeah, no, I can, I mean, do you want to go more in detail? Or do you want to save that for later?
No, we can keep going and talk about it as she starts making some poor decisions.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. I thought her characterization was very, I don't know, I guess it was a little inconsistent and a little just kind of weird.
I think
the acting took me out of it a lot.
Sorry. Well, I don't know. I feel like some of the issues with her character were that she was set up very simplistically, as actually pretty much all of the characters were. They can all be kind of summed up as one or two sentences without losing any of the detail of their character.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's not a film based on characterization.
Oh, for sure.
But I feel like it held well enough to some of the tropes that we're all familiar with that it kind of saw me through. Like, we all know the love triangle. We didn't... You dropped one line about the love triangle and I'm already in.
Yeah, I just say, like, her acting kind of took me out of it, of the film at times. And, yeah, we'll definitely go more in depth about the whole love triangle thing.
Yeah, as we get into later it. Later on. Like how, do you remember when he was going through and he sees the footprint and he comes across this long extinct animal?
Oh, the trilobite?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And he, like, identifies it in, like, 2 seconds. I'm like, okay.
Yeah. Movie magic, man.
Like, okay, there's this animal that's been extinct for, what, 2 million years or something? And he's like, I can identify it from 3 feet away. The usual zoologist.
It's really funny because I know when we were watching this in class, we talked about, and again, this is not a character-driven film in the slightest. So we talk about this in some... We've talked about this in my class. This is a much more thematic film, obviously. It's very much an allegory for the atomic bomb, with Godzilla being the atomic bomb, and how people are reacting to it. And I thought it was very interesting how, like, in that scene when the scientist has the Geiger counter to count radiation, I guess in the environment, you know, he talks to the townspeople, and, you know, saying, like, you know, this is radiation, people need to get away, and, like, people immediately back away. Like, and it's kind of, like, a very subtle but, like, sad kind of thing how commonplace and well-known radiation and, you know, nuclear radiation is mm-hmm, to yeah. these, I guess, provincial people who, like, you're like, well, why would they know about this? Obviously because, you know, the effect of World War II, everyone in Japan knows about, yeah. like, atom bombs and how radiation poisoning will affect other people. So, yeah, that was kind of, like, a very subtle, but definitely, like, it was nuanced, but, yeah. you know, I thought it was well done, because, like, people, you know, immediately backed away, they were, you know, like, oh, what are we gonna do with the water now? You know, all these, like, more practical concerns kind of couched in this weird kind of fantastical kind of film, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
So that was a good touch.
Yeah, so we learned that Gojira is alive and kicking and radioactive because of...
Radioactive! Sorry.
Not the best word choice, I guess.
No, he is radioactive, he is.
Emitting radiation.
yeah, he is
because of repeated H-bomb tests, which disturbed his natural habitat. So that is pretty overt what it's trying to signal, but it works.
Yeah, this thing is not... This movie is very anvilicious, over the top.
In your
we
face.
We will nail it into your brain that this movie is about the atom bomb. Like, I don't know how it would compare to Into the Badlands and the dropping, but, like, they're kind of on that same level. Let me tell you about this thing. Let me show you this thing, and then let me tell you about this thing, so you don't ever forget.
Yeah, there's no way you can watch the movie without knowing what it's about. So
for sure.
There is that. But it, honestly, it also kind of made me think of global warming.
Mm.
Because, like, the whole reason they're facing this monster is because of these bomb tests, which is obviously a human endeavor, and it's now disturbing the Earth environment mm-hmm. to an effect where humans have created a huge ripple from what they have created to Earth, basically. And so,
right.
obviously, they wouldn't have known about global warming. But right. I found it kind of meaningful for kind of today's world.
Yeah, which, there are some parallels.
You know, humans kind of suck sometimes. And we kind of suck at creating global symbiosis with the Earth.
Yeah. I mean, and just to shout out to one of our older podcast episodes, but I definitely talked about in our Pacific Rim episode how similar... this Pacific Rim took a lot of inspiration from the Godzilla films. Mm. And, like, you can see it. There's yeah, a lot of
absolutely.
Instances and parallels. Like, I talked about this in the Pacific Rim episode, I think, part two, but there's this one part where one of the scientists goes on about how we have practically terraformed the Earth for the invading aliens. And that's literally, like, Melissa's talking about how she sees some kind of global warming parallels with the Gojira film. And, yeah, suffice to say there's a lot of connections with Pacific Rim. So, hey, you should check out our Pacific Rim episodes if you haven't listened to them yet.
That was a very nice plug. A+.
I'm just plugging back for one of our older episodes. But I think it'd be kind of fun to watch Godzilla and then watch Pacific Rim right after. And then be like, ah, there's a lot of similarities. But yeah.
I feel like Pacific Rim does a lot of the things a lot more subtly, and yet it becomes somewhat lesser for doing them subtly, if that makes sense.
Yeah. It's trying to do a lot more than I think Godzilla was. I think Godzilla is more simpler in what it was trying to achieve.
Yeah.
Just mainly doing a allegory for the atomic bomb, whereas Pacific Rim is more like, let me try to cram in like 5 different allegories in one film, right. You know?
When you try and do too much, none of them work as well as if you focus on one.
On one thing, yeah.
So, yeah. I like
it. So going, I'm really glad you liked it, because I find with me, especially when I'm rewatching these sci-fi films, it's really funny because I feel like I like the movie more the first time, and then when I watch it the second time, I'm a little bit more critical. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if I quite enjoy it as much.
Right.
But I'm glad that you liked it. I have to say, when I was thinking about when I saw the people protesting, I think it was either in the courtroom scene or right after. And I always think this every time I see old school films or video. People made better protest signs back in the day. That's such a throwaway just thought in my head. But people made better protest signs. Like, they had better handwriting. The materials they used were better. It's completely, like, an irrelevant thought. But I always think it every time I see, like, old movies.
You know who had good protest signs very recently? This is aging the podcast and when we were filming. But in Iceland,
Iceland,
when they were trying to get their head official to leave because of the whole Panama scandal, blah, 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 politics, Panama let's papers, not yeah. deal with it. But the whole point is that they had good signs, so.
I appreciate a good sign from an aesthetic standpoint. I really do. Also, speaking of aesthetics, I also really like the music in this film.
Yes.
I thought, you know, I think just culturally, because you do get a sense, this is, I think, not only the first black and white film we're covering in the podcast, but the first foreign film we're covering in the podcast. Different movies from different countries have very different feels. And I think when it comes to Japanese film, I've seen a couple, and I can say they don't lay on the music as heavily as, say, an American film. They have more silences. In their films, which I guess based on where you're coming from as a viewer, you might feel uncomfortable or find it different or interesting that there's less music. But I really liked the music when it showed up. I thought it was well integrated into the movie. Even though it was kind of sparsely used, I really liked the music. Especially like that kind of military march
kind of theme
for Godzilla. Because again, it just harkens back to World War II. Which I liked.
Yeah, that was a great set of music. And it kept... There wasn't a lot of it, but when it was used, it kept repeating. And mm-hmm. I just really liked the music, I guess. It worked mm-hmm. when they used it. I mean, from my perspective, they probably could have used it more. But I think some of the most meaningful moments were some of the silent moments in the film, because it makes you kind of reflect what you're feeling instead of what the film is telling you to feel.
Right.
And it does kind of make you uncomfortable. Maybe that, I don't know if that was created that way, or maybe just because I'm very used to having a lot of music in my films, but it did make me feel uncomfortable, and it did make me, I think, appreciate those moments more than the musical moments, even though I did very much like the music.
Yeah. Again, I think it comes down to cultural, most of the time it comes down to, like, your cultural background with movies. We are American viewers. We are used to music in movies literally telling us how to feel about a scene. So when we don't have that kind of crutch of swelling music or something, then it's kind of like, oh, how do I actually feel about this scene versus how is this movie telling me to feel about the scene, you know?
Yeah, that actually reminds me of a Buffy the Vampire Slayer episode called The Body. And I won't go off on it, but it's a really, really good episode. And they mm-hmm. don't rely on music to make you feel horror. They just show it to you, and it's very poignant and meaningful.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, we'll put a link to it in the show notes or something. I wrote down, again, my notes are a little bit
haphazard, like,
unreadable. But I wrote down, I love the mise-en-scene, and I believe I meant in the professor's office. Like, the older professor, I mean. Like, he has, like, a little dinosaur skeleton thing, I think, in there, and, like, some other stuff that I really liked. I didn't write in depth because I didn't really want to pause the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Oh, I have some very random note about the boat that people are just kind of chilling out on.
Yeah.
It's really funny. These are very, like, tangential, kind of, like, random personal thoughts that went through my head, so I don't have to take too much stock into this, but everyone's kind of chilling out on that cruise boat, and all of a sudden, they see Godzilla, and everyone runs to one side of the boat, and it just reminded me of a time where me, Melissa, and some of our other friends, we were on a boat, whale watching, not Godzilla watching, and we all ran to one side of the boat, and the whole boat felt like it was tipping over, and I was just thinking, while I was watching the scene, that boat is gonna flip over. I know, because I've been on a boat like this, where we all...
We did not flip over, just...
We didn't flip over, but you know what I'm talking about. It was scary at times.
It was so scary. I knew that it wasn't going to flip in my head, because this must happen every time they go out. But, oh, Lord, was I scared. Because it was just... It was so tipping to one side, and then everyone ran to the other side. It was scary. But...
Yes.
I was just like...
And then I wondered... Oh, sorry.
Oh, no. I was just... I remember that scene too, where it was like a fun swinging party or whatever, and I was just like, you know, I don't see what's going to go wrong here. If I was them, I would totally go on a boat when there's a Godzilla around. It's not a problem.
Yeah, and then I was thinking, we didn't really get any closure on that one random scene, because I wrote down, are the people on the boat dead? ? Because we never saw what actually happened to them after. Did Godzilla eat them? Did they all fall in the ocean and die of radiation poisoning? What happened to these people? We never find out.
Yeah, I have no idea. I thought maybe they were okay. Maybe, like, it just kind of poked its head out and was like, nah, not today.
I feel like, you know, stomping on people in islands, not eating people on cruise ships, too much fancy taffeta and stuff, I guess.
Maybe.
Anyway, so what did I write down? I wrote down love triangle ? I think. Hold on.
I don't think there's a question mark here. I think it's
no. I wrote down
love triangle. Period.
I wrote down love triangle ! That's what I wrote.
Oh,
down.
Okay, that works too.
And then, but I don't. I mean, I found the love triangle overall kind of boring. Didn't really do anything for me too much, but. I kind of, like, what are your thoughts on the love triangle, Melissa?
I liked it because I am a sleazeball. I liked they didn't spend a lot of time on it. I think if we had gotten too much of it, I would have been really exhausted by it. And I like how that we kind of came into it post-conflict, you know what I mean? Because she has already decided.
Yeah.
And so we don't get a lot of, oh, should I choose this person or should I choose that person?
She's going with Team Hawkeye. She's going with Team Hawkeye versus Team Eyepatch Guy.
Well, you know what? If there's a team, I would be on that team. Always go with Team Hawkeye. But I liked that we didn't have her trying to decide between the two of them. Because that's where I really get exhausted with love triangles. That's really, I just pick one and go with it. You just got to flip a coin and do it, okay? But if there's a choice between a hot guy and an eye patch guy, no offense to our eye patch audience.
Yeah, no offense to our eye patch audience. But also, he just had a weird, I don't know, something about Sarazawa was just really
he had a very
off to me.
Very strange demeanor. He seems a little, I don't know, like.
It worked for the film, though.
Oh, yeah.
It worked for his character.
Like, he'd already been somehow corrupted by his research, and it had really kind of done some damage in his heart, not his literal heart, like his metaphorical heart.
Obviously. You get some kind of weird, tortured, mad scientist vibe from this guy, even though we don't know if he's done anything crazy yet, but he just gives off that, like, weird vibe.
Yeah.
But, so I'm looking up the guy's name. It's the eye patch. We're looking up the guy's name. So the character, so the love triangle is I'm going to try to pronounce this correctly. We have Emiko, we have the scientist who is Sarazawa, and we have, and I don't think they mentioned his name, and that's why I never remember it. It's Hideto Ogata, who is a sea captain of the Nankai Salvage Company. He's who I call Hot Guy. He is Team Hot Guy. He is the guy with the white, like wife beater shirt in the very beginning of the film, and he's like chilling out with Emiko, and they're gonna get married and whatever. AKA the guy who helps random little kid with his homework or something. Like, he was such a... You know, that makes me think, too... Oh, sorry, there's a really loud plane passing overhead. That makes me think, too, like, what is the captain's place in the film? He does work with Sarazawa at the end to deliver that, like, you know, weapon.
Right.
But, and he does, he's, like, connected to all these different events. But I don't know if he really does anything until the very end, you know?
No, he's actually very superfluous, actually, as well. I mean,
which is odd, because he's a technically a main character, you know?
Yeah, he doesn't really do anything. He's just there a lot of the scenes. You saying that he's a captain of some ship?
Yeah, because when we first meet him in the very beginning of the film, because he gets the call from command center that, oh, like, 1, 2, 3 ships have just gone down. We need you to get here immediately. So he runs off to go deal with that, but I don't even know if we see him doing anything.
Yeah. I didn't really know who he was. I knew he had something to do with the ships because, yeah, he was called out, but I didn't know that he was the captain and what his role was, and he was just kind of supposed to be there, I guess.
Yeah, he was just, like, tangentially connected to all these different events because he's a sea captain, but he didn't do anything until the very end, you know?
Honestly?
He was kind of related to convincing the doctor to use the weapon.
Actually, now that you mention it, you could completely cut his character, and it would be just as good if you set, like, the other two points of the triangle together.
So, Emiko, Sarazawa would
be the couple.
But I think that's where the complications come in, because why, if they were actually together, would he still be as reluctant to tell her about the technology that he has? And would she still be reluctant to tell other people about this
destroyer? Right, who would she tell?
Yeah, so I kind of see how he's necessary, although he's kind of... It does kind of feel like he's not as big of a character as
they could definitely rework it to make it work without him. But I mean, he's the main character. He's the eye candy. I'm not complaining.
Out of all the it's really funny. Of those three main characters, his actor is the only one still alive today.
Really.
But this dude is still alive. His name is Akira Takarada. He was born on April 29th, 1934, and he's still alive today at the ripe old age of 81.
Wow.
Team Hawkeye.
for the win.
Yeah, but he's still alive and doing his thing. I don't know if he's still acting anymore, but, like, that's pretty cool.
That is pretty cool.
The guy who did Godzilla is still alive and kicking. Okay, so back to the film.
Yeah.
I wrote down, I really like the use of transitions, white transitions, kind of remind me a bit of Star Wars, like,
yeah, old
you know
school.
How they would go to the next scene, but it would kind of wipe.
Yeah, I know what you mean, I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah, no, I kind of like that, it was very old school. And whenever they do that, it kind of feels like chapters, almost, of a book. So that was kind of a nice touch. And I also really liked Sarazawa's room. Like, it was so classic mad scientist cavern lair, but I loved it anyway. For some reason, I got a bit of, like, a Breaking Bad vibe, like, season 3, when that particular lab, like, they have all these crazy beakers and, like, brewing equipment and stuff everywhere. Like, I don't know. I really liked it. It just reminded me. They had one setup, and it just reminded me of this coffee maker they had in, like, season 3 of Breaking Bad.
I'll take your word for that.
Anyway, but I liked that, and then I really, really liked the shot of the fish in the tank. Not when they die, but, like, before.
You mean the original time we see the scene, or when we...
Yeah, the very...
Okay.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, but I'm talking about the first time we see the fish in the tank. And this is before he uses the oxygen destroyer on the fish. I like that shot. It was just so different from the rest of the film. And it was nice, you know? I mean, the only other underwater scenes, quote unquote, we have are later on when we see Godzilla underwater.
Mm, yeah.
But I really liked it, so. I don't know if you have any notes about the scientist's room or lair or anything about
I think it was good. I liked that Sarazawa told her about it.
Because
he loves her. And that is your fatal flaw. Love. Love is your downfall.
I think we need to send Mr. Sarazawa, well, I know he's dead now, but I think we need to send him a copy of Dr. Horrible and kind of see what happens. Just saying.
Okay, very nice.
Listen, man, I just was getting a Dr. Horrible vibe from him, like, kind of. I mean, he obviously didn't have, world domination aspirations, but...
I mean, for all his madness, he was a good guy.
He was a good guy, and he...
He doesn't deserve our mocking.
No, it's true. He died a hero and, you know, sacrificed
himself.
As soon as
he said that, like, he was what? Like, I would rather die than... Don't ever say that. Trust me. Don't ever say I would rather die, because that is setting you up for a bad situation.
Yeah. I love the use of shadows and framing in this film. What did I write? I think I just wrote down some random notes about Sarazawa or the other love interest. I wrote down break up with him, but I don't know why I wrote that. And then I wrote down, he didn't even eat anyone? Oh, that's about Godzilla. That's about Godzilla.
Oh.
Yeah. It's funny, they set him up as some, like, you know, human-eating monster, but he doesn't even eat anyone. He just destroys buildings and happens to kill people while doing this. Well, you know what I mean?
I mean, yeah.
Godzilla. But then he doesn't eat anyone. He doesn't eat anyone.
That fits better with the metaphor of
being
you know, the destruction of war. Mm-hmm, it's not like Americans are much of a cannibals. Not to my knowledge.
Yeah, I guess the atom bomb isn't going around eating specific people. I just thought it was funny because they did set him up that earlier on. Because they're like, he used to sacrifice girls to him, and so he would come and, like, you know, destroy our island or whatever. I was like, not really eating anyone, so.
You know what I thought when I was watching it? This is probably bad. But I was thinking that kind of Godzilla moves the way that I do. That like when I am eating something that I really enjoy, but I'm full, but I don't want to stop eating because I'm really enjoying it, so I have like an extra serving of like anything, like potatoes or whatever, because they taste delicious. And so then after I finish eating and I'm so full, that kind of waddling motion, I was like, oh, it's me.
I'm Godzilla.
How did you know?
Yeah. But... I mean, just, like, small touches of this film, like, again, thinking about how it kind of dates itself, like, Pan Am doesn't exist anymore as an airline, so when I saw Pan American Airlines, I was like, this is hilarious. One question I had was, what's up with the tanks in the film? Because if, you know, you're the one who knows history better than I do, so I'm going to pose this question to you. Right after World War II, I believe Japan was demilitarized, right?
Yes.
So, how do they have tanks in... Like, assuming that Godzilla is, like, an AU of, like, real life... I know it sounds stupid, but, like, okay, so there's, like, the atomic bomb happens in World War II, right? And then we have a universe where Godzilla happens, where this atomic bomb... you know, awakens this monster living in the ocean, and he destroys people and buildings and cities. So, assuming that this is after World War II, and after Japan's been demilitarized, how do they have tanks in, presumably, 54? How do they have tanks?
Is that
logical?
I am not an expert in all historical years and locations, so I can't tell you the specifics exactly. Okay. Maybe I can do some Googling, but I don't know. Did the tanks come earlier in the film or later? Because remember, they were trying to get all the help from people all over the world. Maybe people sent their tanks. Like, they're international tanks. They're tanks of friendship.
Tanks of friendship.
I think I know that
needs to be the episode title. Tanks of friendship needs to be the episode title. I guess they could. That's what I was just trying to wrap my head around. If they were demilitarized, how is it?
I don't know how long it lasted, so I don't want to make any
dubious claims.
Yeah, because I don't know that off the top of my head.
Sure, but that's just like a thought that ran through my mind the second viewing. I was like, oh, they have tanks, and I don't think they should have tanks. But if you frame it from that perspective, like, oh, they got it from international sources, then I guess that makes more sense. I also wrote down that the kind of warning bulletins, I don't know if it was from the TV or from radio or whatever in the movie, but it sounded kind of like those airport announcements, like, do-do-do-do, flight 257 is leaving gate 50. Like, but it was a warning bulletin for Godzilla, and it sounded like an airport, and I just thought that was like a weird moment in the movie.
I'm sorry, I'm still looking up demilitarization of Japan.
It's cool.
I should probably, we can just put it in like the show notes or something, whatever we
okay
find.
Yeah, we'll try to look it up or figure out what's going on with that. I'm trying to get we're running out of time, so I'm trying to run through the rest of my notes as quickly as possible. Please interject if you have any ideas.
Sorry, yeah, I'll put the research aside.
Because I know I've been rambling a lot about my notes, but I don't know what, I mean, have you any important thoughts about the middle of the movie or anything before we get to the end?
No, I think I'm ready to move into the end, which is the cool part.
Oh, yes, this is where all the action goes down. So, you know, Godzilla starts going into the city. I don't think we ever get a indication of what city it is. Maybe it's Tokyo?
It is Tokyo, wasn't it?
Did they explicitly say Tokyo? I kind of assumed it was.
I think it's Tokyo.
Okay.
But
I'm not
ready to swear by it, but I think it's Tokyo.
Okay. So, whatever. Godzilla is entering a very large populated city. I thought, again, I just kind of connect the dots to different movies or stories.
It is Tokyo.
Okay, great. No. That's good, because I wasn't 100% sure. Godzilla's kind of crashing through this, like, electrified fence, and it kind of reminded me of Jurassic Park, except not. Like, they had the electric fences up, and they actually worked in the movie. Not quite so in this case. I wrote, Godzilla uses fire. It is super effective. Like, I was not expecting him to start breathing fire on things. So...
Okay, so... I'm going to hold off so this doesn't become, like, a really long tangent, but this is a very interesting piece of the film for me, because I'd always kind of thought of Godzilla as a metaphor for, you know, atomic bombs, because they were dropped on Japan, obviously, but there were also Tokyo firebombings during World War II, mm-hmm. which were extraordinarily devastating, and depending on which estimates, possibly killed more than either of the atomic bombs. And this is something that obviously the Japanese viewing audience would be very familiar with. And so, given that Tokyo kind of erupts in flames much how it did during World War II, I think that's a very important parallel that sometimes kind of gets lost because we're really focused on the radiation theme. Say that, not to probably do the kiss of death for a podcast, but I will plug another podcast.
Do it, man.
Which I think if you're a history buff fan, you definitely should be listening to. You probably already are, which is Dan Carlin's Hardcore History. He did an episode a few years ago called Logical Insanity, which was actually very much about this and about the atomic bomb and about how... I don't want to put words into his mouth because he is so much more eloquent than I am, but it's about how we do basically crazy things in war, and it's impossible to kind of get yourself into the headspace of people going through really difficult and traumatic issues and really taking apart the difficult decisions made during World War II from a lot of different fronts. It's really, really well done. Highly recommend it. And I will stop talking about the Tokyo firebombings right now. Okay.
I mean, this makes me want to plug another podcast that... but seriously, this is actually... Like this podcast you just talked about is related to the Godzilla story. Mine is kind of related too.
Okay.
So it's not even a plug. Let's be real. Serial is the number one podcast. Everyone listens to it. So I don't need to plug Serial. But as of right now, when we are recording, they just finished up season two of Serial, which is Bo Bergdahl's story. And they basically, I don't think this is too spoilery, but if it's spoilery, you can skip the next 30 seconds. But they basically, I listened to the last episode, and they talk about the insanity of war and how the decisions that are made are kind of crazy and don't make sense. They do mention that a bit as a theme in the last episode of the second season of Serial. So that's it. If you're yearning for more war-related stuff or more history-related stuff, you have Serial, or I guess the podcast that Melissa mentioned earlier to listen to. We can throw those in the show notes, I guess. Podcasts are awesome, guys.
Yeah, they really are. I've been listening to podcasts since 2007, and they're just great. I've gone through so many different iterations, and let's get back to Gojira now.
Yeah. So, okay, so we talked about the fire. Podcasts are awesome. Yes, we talked about the firebombings. And yeah, I think that's definitely, that's a good point to make. Because I was thinking about that too. I was like, why are they, there seems to be a lot of shots of fire going on. And I wasn't sure if that was a byproduct of nuclear bombs, although I'm sure fires were set because of those as well. But I think your explanation about the firebombing being more devastating, I think that makes a lot more sense to me. Let's see. I really like the, you know, I don't really know how they did this, but one of the shots I was kind of more impressed with from a special effects standpoint was when Godzilla is kind of destroying buildings. There's one shot where he's kind of over this building that has people in it, and then people run away from their windows, and then the building falls down. I'm sure there's a way they, like, did it with, like, models or whatever, but I really like that scene. It was such a, I don't know. That was one of the more impressive things for me, special effects-wise.
One thing about the special effects, which we've kind of been a little bit harping on, but when I was watching it, I was thinking this. It literally does not matter because, honestly, I couldn't do the special effects that they're doing. I can make fun of it all I want, and that I'm used to a lot more finesse from my movies, but I could not produce what they produced in the special effects department, so props to them, honestly.
I love that shot where the TV broadcaster is, like, up on the top of the tower, and he's just, like, giving a play-by-play of Godzilla's rampage through Tokyo.
Oh, yeah.
And then, all of a sudden, he gets really close to the tower, and then the guy's like, well, sayonara, guys. I guess I won't be seeing you. Bye. And then he just promptly dies after Godzilla just, like, I guess, destroys the tower. It gave me a very big War of the Worlds feel. I'm talking about the radio drama that came out in, like, the 30s by Orson Welles. You should really check that out. It's such a great radio drama. It's really classic. But there's a scene just like that in War of the Worlds where this guy is in New York and he's giving a play-by-play about the aliens destroying New York City and then promptly dies in the end. So yeah, I don't know, that probably wasn't a shout out to War of the Worlds, but I really liked it regardless.
I mean, it's, you know, it's very dangerous being a reporter on the front lines, and getting the stories, information from them is a privilege and not a guarantee. It was really a nice piece. I liked that part a lot.
So I'm going to skip some of my less important notes and move on to Sarazawa in his lab when, you know, it's after the Tokyo attack. People are getting really desperate, and Emiko goes, you know, Emiko kind of reveals the oxygen destroyer to her boyfriend, fiance, whatever. And he goes to Sarazawa's office and is like, you need to let us use this very dangerous weapon. And we had the little flashback where, you know, he drops the oxygen destroyer in the tank of fish, and then Emiko screams and, like, faints or whatever.
Of course.
I have to say, I wrote down Sarazawa is Heisenberg. Like, he just is the guy from Breaking Bad. You know, minus the meth selling. there was just the eye patch and just, like, I don't think Sarazawa actually says, I am the danger, but he, like, basically makes himself out to be like, I could destroy the world with this oxygen destroyer, but I won't. Or will I? I just got this whole Heisenberg feel. But then with the love triangle, between Ogata, Emiko, and Sarazawa, I was just like, look at this male posturing that's going on. Ugh, male posturing. I don't know quite what I was referring to, but I think it was... No. But it was... I wrote it down, so it definitely happened. There was definitely something... When they started kind of getting into a little fight about, should we really use Oxygen Destroyer, it was... I definitely got the feel that there was a lot more love triangle... love triangle stuff behind making decisions than just scientific and... saving the world stuff going on.
That's very
which
true.
Is a little bizarre.
I really liked like the theme though, where Sarazawa has this horror at the thing that he created. I mean, that's just like a beautiful, horrible running theme throughout history where, mm-hmm. you know, humanity has created horrible things and the creator does not have control over what they have bequeathed to the world. Like, I mean, yeah. you even look at, you know, the Nobel Peace Prize, you know, that was created. I don't want to go too in depth, but, you know, Alfred okay. Nobel was known for dynamite and did not want that to be his legacy. And so the Nobel comes from him and giving his money to that. I mean, it just...
That's really interesting.
It's very difficult, and I feel like, you know, given modern society, you probably didn't have this as much back in the days when the most impressive weapons were, like, sticks and stones. But, you know, when you look at, you know, some of the people who are... even just working on, you know, the Manhattan Project, you know, yeah. the horror at the thing that you've created is really something that resonates.
What's that, like, classic line? It's like, I am such and such destroyer of worlds, or whatever.
Oh, yeah. I don't...
I'll try to throw in the show notes if I can. I feel like there's gonna be a lot of show notes for this episode. But, yeah... I definitely see Sarazawa's reaction to the oxygen destroyer almost, it definitely parallels the whole atomic bomb thing. You know, yeah. like, I've seen what a horrible invention can do to a people, and I don't want my work to fall to the wrong hands, you know,
right.
in a similar fashion. So, it's just, like, double the impact because it's kind of a foil, or I don't know if foil's the right word, but like it is kind of thinking about the atomic bomb at the same time.
Right.
While we're talking about this oxygen destroyer.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, and I will say mm-hmm. that the quote, I looked it up, now yeah. I am become death, the destroyer of worlds from Oppenheimer.
Okay, yeah.
We can still link to it, but...
Yeah. Definitely throw it in the show notes.
But I will say that yeah. the oxygen destroyer, one of the things that he says is that there are no good uses for it.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. Especially when you compare it to, you know, nuclear energy.
Right.
Because on one hand, you have a really potentially amazing use for nuclear research. But on the other hand, you have absolute tragedies like what happened in Japan a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean...
A few years ago? Are we talking about the 2011? Okay.
5 years ago, then.
I was just like, are we talking about the earthquake thing, or are we talking about, like, the 40s atomic bomb?
No.
So I was like, what are you talking about?
Sorry, I should have clarified.
Yeah, okay. I was just like, Melissa?
That too.
But yeah. I mean, I do think, yeah, Oxygen Destroyer doesn't really have any good uses, but at least with nuclear power, we can use it for energy, which is a good source.
Yeah, I don't know if that piece was kind of a condemnation of the other applications of nuclear research, but I don't know.
Right, it could have been.
I'm not sure.
I think I wrote down in my notes... Okay, so I guess there are two more notes I have about Godzilla. And again, one of them kind of harkens back a little bit to Pacific Rim a bit. But it's interesting how the older scientist is really upset that they're going to, you know, kill Godzilla. He wants to study and understand Godzilla. And it definitely reminded me of Newton Geisler in the Pacific Rim films, mm-hmm. where he's very much like, I want to understand and learn about the kaiju, and not necessarily just outright destroy them. I don't know if I'm injecting fandom stuff into, like, my interpretation of that, but he did have that same thing where he was like, I want to do more research on these creatures before we just outright destroy them. So it kind of just reminded me of that, and in a way, I mean, I don't know how you felt about Godzilla at the end, but I feel like we're supposed to feel kind of bad for Godzilla, you know?
I mean, I think one of the takeaways is that although he is a symbol for, you know, atomic bomb research and everything that goes along with that, it's also kind of a symbol for Japan.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
You know, because the characters are debating whether they should use a horrific weapon to battle, you know, a monster. I don't know how to say this without being offensive. But, you know, they're talking about whether they should use a horrible weapon to battle Godzilla. Is that justified? Is that okay? And it's very much reminding me of the debate that still goes on today, whether it was right to use atomic bombs in Japan, whether, mm-hmm. you know, ending the war sooner was worth the civilian casualties and things like that. So I think it works on a number of different levels, and I really liked that it wasn't just a condemnation of Godzilla or the character.
Yeah. Because we almost kind of see, even though Godzilla is a symbol of the nuclear bomb, I mean, Godzilla is also a victim of the nuclear bomb.
Right, absolutely.
Like, he's been driven out of his home, been awakened, is so radioactive that he is actually physically capable of breathing fire and generating energy. Like, and he is destroying things, but not necessarily, like, in a targeted way. So it's really, it's like, really interesting how Godzilla functions. Like, he is the bomb, he also is the war, but he's also the victim, you know?
Right, absolutely.
Like, I think it's weird, because, like, yeah, you have to destroy him to end, you know, to end his rampages, but I think we are meant to feel a little bit bad for him and feel sympathy because he was also affected by the nuclear bomb. Which is, and it's so funny to me how, you know, this is such a serious film, and then, like, what, like, after 5 films, they just started making parodies and, not parodies, really, but more, like, comedic.
Right.
Sillier films, like Godzilla versus Mothra, a giant moth creature. Like, it's really interesting how it moves so far away from that serious, like, atomic bomb theme to, like, something as dumb as a giant moth versus a giant dinosaur.
Well, I mean, I was reading about it that, you know, when they took it to America and they re-edited it for American audiences and they kind of took out some of the more serious allegory pieces, it was actually re-released in Japan. And people went and saw the Americanized version as well.
Oh,
and
I see.
That, I don't know how popular it was compared to the original, but I think there must be something enjoyable about not having to deal with things that are quite as serious.
Yeah, like the Transformer films or something.
Yeah.
You just want to see, I don't know, monsters, or I guess in the case of Transformers, robots beating each other up? Like,
I don't know.
Yeah. Anyway.
I blocked those films from my mind.
But yeah, I mean, and then we end with that little final note from the older scientist about how if we're not careful, another Godzilla will emerge in the world. Dun, 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 dun.
Dun, dun, dun. Takeaway so, is don't use nukes, kids.
Basically. Yeah, so I don't know. I think that's all my notes about Godzilla. Do you have any notes about anything you wanted to say before we sign off?
There were a few moments in the movie where I got, like, chills, and I was like, this Ooh. Is awesome. I didn't actually write them down, so, but I wrote it especially towards the ending where you see the devastation that Gojira kind of caused, and you see the human side of it, and you see, like, the kid who lost her mom, and you see, like, that's it, you know?
That's, like, the heart of the story, I guess. Like,
yeah.
Or not the heart,
it's
but...
a piece. It's a running theme. And I don't know. If I had made it, it would be more of a theme. But that's why I don't make things like that. Because I don't know how to be subtle as much as I condemn other people for doing the same thing.
Ah, subtlety.
It's really hard.
Selfie is hard.
When you have a really strong message that you want to convey, you just want to make sure that people get it, you know?
Yeah.
But
I understand. Like, there's definitely a project I've made where I go too subtle and people are like, I don't understand what this is about. And I'm like, oh, I was so worried about being over the top that I need to actually be over the top.
It's hard. Props to creators everywhere.
Yeah. Props to Godzilla. Really good film. A really classic film. If you know, for some reason just listen to this whole episode and you still haven't seen Godzilla, go out and watch it. Go out and find that rare $4 Amazon copy and watch it, because it's worth it. And yeah, I guess that's it for this episode of Sci-Fi in Color. You can, again, find us on Facebook, Tumblr, Twitter. You can email us at sfincolor@gmail.com, and please leave us reviews on iTunes. That would really help us out. Yeah, that's it for us, and Maggie signing off.
Okay.
And I'll see you later.
Next week will be
probably going back to
Sense8, right?
Wait, no. Yeah, I think we're gonna go back to Sense8.
Yeah, so that'll be fun. So... I'm excited to go back to that. And I really enjoyed talking about this, and we should probably do more foreign films and do more old films, and it's fun.
Yeah.
I think that's it.
Okay, cool. Well, see ya.
Bye-bye.